From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Watch TV for 15 minutes, and the ads come at you.
Rated M for mature.
No onions, please.
Jomo! Jomo! Extra lettuce.
Wendy's fresh.
Not that nasty.
Shredded mess.
Where sun come, and we get it.
I'm addicted to cigarettes. It's hard to stop. It makes me feel down, low by myself.
The Visa Sky Campbell move sideline to sideline, end zone to end.
Learning Curve is proud to support Thomas and Friends on PBS Kids.
And the best part, in each hand, she has a cold Bud Light. Good day, gentlemen.
Good day indeed. TV is not alone in making the pitch. On radio, along the highways, on the internet, in movies, in public service announcements, on the sides of buses and even cars, ads are everywhere. At times, annoying, humorous, touching, infuriating, even poignant. Some of us may have learned to tune them out, but that perhaps is a sign of just how prevalent they are. So, aside from the message of the individual ads themselves, what message does advertising as a whole send? Does it add to hyper-consumerism or somehow harm children? Or does it provide information and insight into products and services that we need? In his new book, Selling the Dream, John Hood argues that not only is advertising good business, it is, quoting here, morally consistent with the principles of our democratic society. Principles, he says, such as freedom of choice, competition, and innovation. And today we're talking with John Hood about the culture of advertising. In addition to writing Selling the Dream, John Hood is president of the John Locke Foundation, which advocates free markets and a libertarian perspective. That would be the case, John Hood. Welcome back to The State of Things.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. In your view, is advertising overkill? Is it harmful? Or is it a necessary component of a free market system? The number again is 1-877-962-9862. In the preface to your book, John Hood, Selling the Dream, you ask the question, what about the marketing process is worth celebration? And you suggest that there's a lot to celebrate there.
Indeed. I came to this topic of advertising in part because I had written a previous book about 10 years ago called The Heroic Enterprise, Business and the Common Good, which looked at the issue of corporate social responsibility and more generally, what is the social impact and influences and implications of business activity. And I found during discussions of that set of issues that it was a lot easier in a public sphere, in a debate context, to defend businesses or business leaders if they were inventors or innovators or good managers or good investors. But what if they were good at sales? This was sort of where the wheels came off the cart from a rhetorical perspective. And I just sort of stored that away in my head. Let's go back to that at some point and try to figure out what could we learn by studying carefully how marketing affects us. What is marketing for? Is it all a waste of time? Does it make things cost too much? Does it make us buy too many things? And I guess when I got finished with my examination and wrote the book, the answer was sometimes. I mean, obviously there are ads that are deceptive. There are ads that violate various moral standards that we have, either in what we're seeing or what we're not seeing. But in general, what I concluded is that marketing, that advertising specifically, is a critical part of how we operate a capitalist economy, which is essentially meaning how do we get what we want at the price we want as often as we want. That's really what you're trying to do in any economic system, and advertising helps us as consumers do that.
Well, you know, one of the raps on advertising is that it's a matter of want and need here. Do people need to be pitched things that they don't necessarily need? And that advertising creates this want mm-hmm. on their part. That these might be items that before the ad ever appeared, they didn't know that they needed this thing in their life, you know, whether it's the Ronco salad slicer or what. You contest that point, though.
Well, I do in a sense. I mean, obviously, advertising serves in part to let people know about something they didn't previously know about, and perhaps even to attract them to purchase something they had not intended to purchase before they saw the ad. So in that sense, I'm that would be silly to debate that premise. Of course, that's true. But the question is that bad? I mean, this idea at least stems from the writings about 100 years ago of a man named Thorsten Veblen. And John Kenneth Galbraith is a more recent exponent of the same view. And the view is that advertising, that modern marketing is a kind of a squirrel wheel problem. We're just letting people know that something is there, so they'll race to get it, so they'll get it, so we'll give them something else to do, and they're not going anywhere. And Galbraith famously said that people in the 19th century, before mass advertising on television or radio, they knew that they wanted to eat. They knew that they needed clothes. They didn't need an ad man to tell them these things. Well, that's an extremely constricting view of how we form our own preferences. I mean, obviously, people in primitive societies had no aspiration for opera because opera hadn't been invented yet. And people in the 21st century or in the 20th century would have no aspiration for the internet because until the last decade of the 20th century, it was unimaginable. So when something comes along that's new or different or interesting, potentially, advertising, one of its roles is indeed to let people know about that. I don't see that as a negative.
Well, arguably, things such as opera and the internet become institutions or things that, well, for opera fanatics at least, it's something they can't live without. The internet, something that many more people feel they can't live without. But there's a lot of other stuff out there. My mother might call it guts a deal. Just the things that it's just stuff in a house that you don't need. And that's being pitched too. And that's part of the idea of a consumer society, that somebody's going to make these things and then somebody's going to sell them and then somebody's going to buy them and later on figure I didn't really need those things at all.
Well, obviously, we as consumers are also human beings. We are imperfect. We have flaws. We make poor decisions. No matter what position in life you are and whatever occupation or role you're playing, you're going to make some poor decisions. I didn't really need that particular radio, or I didn't need that particular piece of clothing. I thought I'd wear it more than I did. That's true. But most businesses prosper not by selling things once, but by selling things again. And there's a reason why so many most products fail. Most efforts to market a new product fail. Only, I think there was a study in the 1980s of thousands and thousands of new consumer products. About 15% of them were still around 10 years later. So most products fail probably because they don't really deliver on the initial promise. I bought this new Coca-Cola product, for example, and it didn't taste very good, and so I didn't buy it again. I mean, the advertising may have been very effective in getting you to buy it one time. But consumers still have the ultimate power here. They decide whether to make a product viable over time. They decide whether they're going to fill their house up with items that they rarely use. In one person's eyes, a purchase may be a frivolous want. But in another person's eyes, that lipstick really enhanced that experience they had. I know lots of people, and you know, it may even include myself, for whom the concept of living without Star Trek is really impossible to imagine, and yet for others that will be perceived as entirely a frivolous want.
I have a whole season of DVDs to sell you then. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. We're talking today with John Hood, author of the new book, Selling the Dream, Why Advertising is Good Business. What's your take on that? Do you appreciate advertising, or do you find it something that you'd rather there was less of? 1-877-962-9862 is the number. You make the case here that advertisers aren't selling their products. This might be marketing 101, that advertisers aren't selling products so much as they are selling desire and dreams. And they went in the form of a lot of advertising now. Well, it's not just buy this, it's good for you. It's, well, here's the life you could have if you buy this.
Indeed. And there's actually nothing new about that role that advertising plays. In the book, I talk about a print ad that was in a newspaper published by a man named Benjamin Franklin, that people may have heard of. In addition to being innovative in many other ways, he was one of America's early advertising innovators. And when he invented the Franklin stove, which was a commercial enterprise for him, even though he didn't patent it, he did want to sell the stove, he had advertisements in his own publications for his stove. And he didn't just say, you know, you can buy the stove at Mr. Smith's shop on First Avenue in Philadelphia for, you know, $2 or something. He said, what would it be like to have this kind of stove? Well, this is how your home would feel, and you wouldn't age as rapidly because the stove wouldn't aggravate your skin as much. So there's nothing new about this kind of of aspirational use of advertising. If you have these certain goods or services, you can achieve a certain aspiration. Does that always succeed? Of course not. People buy four-wheel drive SUVs imagining that one day they'll take it off-road and go rocketing through the hillside, and then they never do. I mean, there are aspirations that never get realized, but actually a lot of aspirations do get realized. Some people really enjoy having that vehicle or piece of clothing or that night out that is advertised on television.
And the case you make about Benjamin Franklin was that he was one of the very earliest copywriters.
He was indeed. Advertising had been, in the print world, had been very much what's called informational advertising. This is available. You know,
it's this big.
Right. And so Franklin was getting at not only the use of copy, but also the use of design. Actually using white space was something that Franklin really initiated to try to break up those very boring lines of gray text. The book is not really about American advertising by itself. But what I found is that a lot of our innovations, a lot of what we do in modern advertising comes from America. America is the birthplace of modern marketing.
So are we a nation of sellers?
In many ways, we're a nation of buyers and sellers.
Okay. We are talking today with John Hood, author of the book Selling the Dream, Why Advertising is Good Business. And we welcome your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava. Americans spend billions each year buying cosmetics, automobiles, and beer, among many other things. And the catalyst that moves consumers to buy these items is advertising. John Hood is president of the John Locke Foundation and author of the new book, Selling the Dream, Why Advertising is Good Business. And we are taking your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Is advertising good business? Is it good for life in general? We're curious to hear what you think. 1-877-962-9862. And Chris joins us now. Hi there, Chris.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome
to
the show.
I have no doubt that advertising is good business. You know, otherwise it wouldn't be so pervasive. But my question is a good culture. And I think that marketing is responsible primarily for the conversion of the idea of a good citizen into that of a good consumer. I mean, it's almost as if the only power that people enjoy now is the power to buy things. And I think that's pretty insidious. I also think that marketing sort of unhinges meaning from words. I mean, there's a whole class of words now that are only used in advertising and nobody would ever use in regular speech.
Such as what words?
Well, an easy example of, let's say, a rote advertising phrase that's been rendered meaningless is now, I mean, there's no food manufacturer that would ever say anything but made with the freshest ingredients. I mean, no matter how banal or processed the thing is, it's got to be made with the freshest ingredients. So what this does is creates this class of words that we just ignore because it's a thing that's got to be said. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then I have one final point. Advertising exists not to describe a product, but to sort of create falsely transcendent feelings, to sort of hijack your synapses and create these associations, false associations with this product. And that's what the whole project of branding is all about, is to like sort of associate these things that are sort of transcendent human values with a product or a brand name, even more so.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I'd say that, you know, when people wonder, here's the thing you have to remember about advertising, why it's so pervasive. People wonder why, for example, the news is so focused on gory, terrible stories, why there isn't good news. You know, the whole concept of why if it bleeds, it leads. Well, I think it's because when you're watching TV, you are not the consumer. You are the product. You are the demographic being sold to advertisers. TV exists for advertising, not the other way around.
Well, I'm going to put your thoughts to John Hood. John Hood, on that last point, you write that was actually something that newspapers in America hit upon sometime in two centuries ago, was the idea of selling their readership
right
to advertisers.
Right. Well, to put a different gloss on that, the discovery of advertising for newspapers was the way we created independent objective journalism. Before that time, it was impossible to fund journalism simply by charging people per copy, because people would just read each other's copies and the economics didn't work. And so newspapers until the 1830s, they were subsidized by political parties, churches, governments in the form of publishing contracts and advertising. By in the 1830s, when the New York newspapers went into the advertising business in a big way, they absolutely cut their price very low. That's the origin of the term penny press. And they said, yes, we're going to market to potential advertisers that we have this audience to inform with their information, and that will allow us to turn what was a vice, people passing along copies of the newspaper, into a virtue. The more copies are passed along, the more eyeballs see the copy that you're writing without having to spend more money. More generally, to Chris, I would say that his critique is a one of almost ancient lineage. It's certainly been around a really long time, the idea that advertising distracts us. In fact, there's a whole series of scholars and literature on the subject called the Republican with a small r critique, which is to say we should be citizens, not consumers. Advertising forces us into a consumerist mindset. And that's the thing I could say about this is I discuss this at great length in the book and talk about how do people actually respond to advertising? Does it manipulate them? Do they manipulate advertisers? I would argue more the latter.
How is a consumer manipulating an advertiser?
Consumers have the ultimate power. Chris said that all the consumer can do is buy. Well, that's a tremendously powerful tool, is to not buy. And as I said, most products that are attempted to be advertised fail. They flop. People don't buy them. So if advertising manipulated our synapses in some nefarious way, then advertisers could get away with it whatever they wanted to. And the reality is they mostly don't work. Most advertising campaigns fail, just like most new business enterprises fail, because we're testing things. We're, entrepreneurs, businesses are saying, well, maybe they'll buy this. And they go out and try that, and they try various advertising pitches to express the information that this product is available and what it might be used for. And lots of times consumers say, I think I'll pass on that. And that's an extremely powerful tool that tells businesses, tells advertisers what to do, mm-hmm. not the other way around.
But Chris also had what I would take as an aesthetic argument, mm-hmm. and there are many aesthetic arguments against advertising in general and certain types in particular. But let's just talk about the way he was suggesting it corrupted our language.
Yes.
By these phrases that are, as he said, made with the freshest ingredients, you know, and you can get this and more, you know. What of that? Is it cheapening the language? Well, you know, you also have people throwing around the word natural and light and organic is being corrupted too in some places.
Yes, though, of course, part of how language is formed and how it is sustained is a transactional process. Who decided what organic or fresh or natural means? It wasn't, you know, Noah Webster or something. It's the way we commonly use a word. The reason why this terminology is used in advertising is because people are wanting things that are natural, things that are fresh. Some people are wanting things that are organic. I frankly don't understand that, but they do. And so the real question is, going to the store and buying that product that was advertised as fresh one time, I mean, maybe you're swindled because it turns out that it wasn't fresh, it doesn't taste right. But if you buy it and you like it and you buy it again and you like it again, and as long as there is truth in labeling so that you're not labeling something as in a fraudulent way, then it seems to me that people are defining and using these terms the way we define and use all terms, which is through transactions. You and I kind of jointly decide, is libertarian the correct term to describe the John Locke Foundation? Is it free market? Well, different people bring different baggage to every single word. Some people hear libertarian and think one thing. Some people hear libertarian and think another. The same is true with all the terminology we use in our economic transactions.
Okay. We go to Wendy, who is in Pittsburgh. Greetings, Wendy.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to make two points. I'm a small business owner, and we opened up in 2000 and started advertising. Actually, for the first 2 years, all of our salary went into advertising because it is so vital for a small business that's opening. You just need to get people to know that you were there and to just walk in the door so that then they can decide whether yes or no they are interested in something you've got. And it's interesting because 5 years later, and we still do lots of print advertising, and we do challenges on public radio, and people still come in the door and say, why don't we know you're here? Do you advertise? And it makes us wonder sometimes, well, what do we have to do to get the message out? And because you have to get the message out if you're a new business, there's an incredible cost. And most of your discussion has been pretty much, I think, geared towards national brands, big boxes, chains. But for a small business, advertising is very challenging and very expensive, but it's also very important.
Do you feel like you're advertising in the right places? Or are you rethinking that if people are coming in and saying, where are you?
It's very difficult to know. Actually, as I was waiting to come on the radio, I'm sticking stickers on our holiday mailing that we're sending out to the folks who've come in our shop to remind them to please, you know, we still exist. Come down to Pittsburgh and see us. It's very hard. I would say that word of mouth is by far the best kind of advertising, but with that, you have very little control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate the caller bringing up the critical issue of small firms, small businesses, how advertising helps or hinders their ability to get a foothold in a market that may be dominated by big players. John Wanamaker, the famous retail store magnate, once famously said that half of all advertising is wasted. He just didn't know which half. And so, you know, lots of advertising messages are wasted. I'm here to tell you, anybody who's listening who is an advertiser, if you send me 25 circulars advertising the availability of, you know, let's say shampoo and shower products, you're probably wasting your money because I don't much care. I'll just buy a store brand. I don't care about that. But other people respond favorably to that. So a lot of advertising messages have to do with targeting, you know, which is that, all as you were getting at, Melinda, who is your real audience and what's the best advertising medium to reach that audience? We have more options today than we've ever had before. The marketing mix is very complicated. Broadcast TV advertising is probably going to continue to wane in the whole, and other kinds of advertising are going to wax. But small businesses benefit more from the existence of advertising than large ones. Let me put on my sort of free market and analyst hat for just a moment.
But did you ever take it off, though?
Well, we're talking about advertising and how it works in business, but what I'm going to say now has to do with looking beyond the superficial. Superficially, it looks like when government comes in and regulates advertising, they're doing so to try to protect consumers from fraud or wasting their money or whatever. But a lot of what happens in history and in today's world is that big companies love advertising restrictions. They welcome them. They welcome advertising restrictions because it quashes all the potential challengers to their dominant position. And so you certainly wouldn't want to try to come in and limit what people can advertise, how they can advertise, in a way that, contrary to your intention, would simply allow the big companies who've already established their brand names for decades to dominate, and preventing all those small firms, I'm a fan of a couple, I'm not going to mention their names, but a couple of small game companies that have come into existence in the last 10 years, competing with the big Milton Bradleys and the Avalon Hills, because they've been able to skillfully use advertising to tell people, we have something different. Come try our product.
But what about the caveat emptor, the buyer beware issue? We touched on it just a second ago about the way different words get used and sometimes abused. Let's just take the issue like of organic being mm-hmm. used about something. There's some debate about who should be able to put that label, whether, you know, chemicals never came near the food when it was raised. And so should a purchaser have a reasonable expectation that when it says organic on the label, it should never have had chemicals come near it? Is there not a role for a standard to be set? Whether it's the government, it usually would be saying you can't put that label on your food unless it is indeed purely, truly organic in most people's understanding. Is there not a place for some government regulation in that? And that would that really keep some small business owner from, you know, trying to make a go of it against a large food company?
The short answer to that is yes. Of course, government has a legitimate role in policing the problem of fraud. But it's easier to just make that statement than to define in particular cases, whether something is fraudulent. I would hope, by the way, that consumers are not expecting organic food to never have chemicals. You know, obviously food is made of chemicals. A lot of these definitions
man-made
are very strange.
We'll call
right, but even
chemical.
Even man-made chemical doesn't really capture it, because you could, in 300 years ago, through farming techniques, you could engineer things that wouldn't have happened in the force of nature. So, but this is what actually we're sort of demonstrating the problem, which is that there is no obvious definition of every term. There is no obvious answer regulatory-wise to every potential allegation of fraud. We're going to have to do this on a case-by-case basis through the courts and occasionally through regulatory interventions when you have something that is clearly, clearly fraudulent. But when you're in this gray area where you could defend a proposition and someone else could challenge the proposition, my impulse is to say, just let them battle that out in the marketplace of ideas. Let somebody else come in and say, we have real organic food. Melinda's company has fake organic food. I mean, just let them say that.
But sometimes the way it shakes out in the marketplace is the large agribusiness company can put that organic label on their food because it may have a bigger advertising budget to do so and put it in more places and outsell the guy who really has what a lot of people might be looking for in their organic food,
the smaller guy. We need to find some creative ways for that guy to get his message out.
Okay. Perhaps a bigger advertising budget is what you're getting.
Or not necessarily bigger, maybe more effective, better targeted to the real audience. A lot of advertising expenditure is wasted on people who will never buy the product.
Kevin joins us now from Chapel Hill. Hi, Kevin. It sounds like you might be on the road.
Yeah, I am. Hey, you know, I called for a different matter, but now that you're talking about organics, I think you need to realize that the FDA is looking at that and has been highly influenced by the food industry in terms of what the designation of organic food is,
right.
And that has come at the detriment of some of the smaller farmers who are, let's say, 100% organic versus the new rules, which are somewhat less stringent,
right.
In fact, much more less stringent.
Okay, well, so we might have to save this one. Why don't we save the organic for another day? But was there something about advertising in particular?
The most important thing is that when you're advertising and there are advertisements, it must be clear to the viewer that you are witnessing or you're hearing an advertisement. There's got to be transparency. As an example, you know, public radio, UNC, has just made an agreement with, I guess, the American Tobacco building, right?
We're sitting in it. We're broadcasting from there, and there's a Lucky Strike tower. I think I can see the edge of it out the window here. Yeah.
All right, and your relationship with them is not just because they're good people and they're letting you use that space, but now you're announcing that you're broadcasting from this new building, and in effect, you know, they want to. They want to have full occupancy of that complex, and they're trying to attract new tenants, and you're advertising this building.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's so subtle, and it's not at all transparent that we know that you're doing an ad for American Tobacco or whatever this complex is called.
Well, I haven't gotten a memo from management, so I don't know if I'm speaking management's line on this. But I'll just tell you what, as I understand it, there is in public broadcasting underwriting credits, which some people might say is the public broadcasting version of advertisements. At the beginning of our program here, we do say that we are coming from the place you mentioned, the American Tobacco Historic District.
Exactly.
But it's not, American Tobacco did give our radio station 8,000 square feet here for space that we needed because we were getting too big for the old building. So there is that transparency, is there not? Saying there's not enough transparency?
I don't think there is enough transparency.
What would you want us to say?
Well, I mean, I don't know if the issue here is specifically the public radio's relationship, but we come to public radio for a lack of commercialization. We want you to be very unbiased in your approach to everything that could happen on the radio. And when you get into relationships, it becomes more and more difficult to be unbiased. The expert that you have on was talking about the free press before and how having advertisements allows, the newspapers to do their jobs better because they are less, let's say, I didn't really understand the logic, but they're less influenced by outside factors. And I would argue that, it's exactly the HBOs of the world. It's the XM stereos. It's the Sirius now where they don't have advertising, that's where the most unbiased, that's where the most fruitful artistic license is happening. And you'll notice that advertising is what restricts this creativity, which restricts the sharing of ideas because
Okay, and if I could just explain perhaps the difference between HBO and public radio is HBO has people who, and I appreciate a lot of their programming too, and the lack of commercials or underwriting credits there, but they do have people who are paying specially for those programs that air there. Public radio for the longest time was getting some money from the government, and that's really petered out and relies on listeners for support as well, and increasingly from those who are providing underwriting credits, so who are giving the station money in exchange for a 10 or 15 second mention that they're supporting the station. Thank you for your call, Kevin. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. We're talking with John Hood. His new book is called Selling the Dream: Why Advertising is Good Business, and we will get to more of your calls about advertising. 1-877-962-9862 on the State of Things. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and we are talking this hour with John Hood. He is head of the John Locke Foundation, described variously as a conservative or libertarian think tank based in Raleigh.
I prefer the term wise. Wise think tank.
Okay. I'm not going to make the judgment here. His new book is called Selling the Dream: Why Advertising is Good Business, and we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Advertising in many forms, just before the break, talking even about public radio and underwriting that it may receive or gifts of space such as we received here in Durham recently, where we're broadcasting from now. 1-877-962-9862 is the number. Talk about yet another issue with advertising, because, John, you would take what might be described as more of a no-holds-barred approach, like the government should have the least involvement in what is advertised out there. The two things. One, cigarette ads were banned from the airwaves 30, 35, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you make the case in the book that that may not necessarily have been a good thing.
Well, if your goal was to communicate to people effectively and broadly over the course of many, many years that cigarettes had health risks, then you shouldn't have, not you personally, but the state should not have banned the cigarette ads of the 1950s that were largely about health claims. I mean, one cigarette company would say, our cigarettes are not as dangerous as. Well, the federal government decided that these claims weren't sustainable because they didn't want to have to get into the business of evaluating whether one cigarette was less or more dangerous than another. But the big companies, again, not to tie this all back into American Tobacco, but American Tobacco, for example, was not at all unhappy when those ads were banned by the federal government, because those ads were primarily coming from Brown and Williamson and Lorillard trying to get a bigger market share against the big dominant players that already dominated the cigarette industry. And the big boys in the tobacco industry at the time cried crocodile tears at most when the feds came in and said, you cannot make those health claims. Our cigarettes are less damaging than. And that probably suppressed a very effective way of communicating that cigarettes had health consequences, which would have perhaps sped up the realization among the public that cigarettes, maybe there's something we ought to think about. Maybe we ought to stop smoking. Maybe we ought to think about cutting down on smoking or doing something to reduce the health consequences of our activity.
But generally, it's thought that by not having the ads on TV, people would be less inclined to pick up smoking.
Yes, I know, but that's highly unlikely. If you look at the evidence of the countries that did and did not ban cigarette advertising, there's not appeared to be any effect on the trend lines in smoking. This is almost a canard, but I think it's still true that advertising in this context of consumer products is largely about influencing your choice of brand. It's not saying, oh, you know, cigarettes, I hadn't heard about those before. Maybe I'll try one. There are lots of other influences, your parents, your peers in the schoolyard, other kinds of media that have smoking in them that influence your knowledge of cigarette smoking. And frankly, there's just no evidence at all that the advertising ban has affected the smoking trend. It may have affected the choice of brands, but it didn't really affect, as far as I can read the evidence, it did not hasten the decline of smoking.
But it would never have depicted smoking as being uncool. I take your point that the smoking was happening in the movies and other places where it was being depicted as something that was very suave and so forth. But the ads would never really depict somebody coughing or doing any of those the side effects of smoking of being unhealthy. They would depict
they
be selling the dream.
They might have a doctor, and in fact they did. Chesterfield, I think it was, or Lucky Strikes One had an ad campaign where a doctor came on and said these brands, because they have filters or whatever, are less irritating and less dangerous than these other brands. And I'm not trying to defend cigarette companies. I'm really not. I'm just observing that when we rush in and we assume that we can make things better with a ban or a prohibition or a limitation, there are unanticipated consequences, many of them adverse consequences. I think the antidote for speech or communication or information you don't agree with is to advance your own views. It is not to try to suppress the other side's communication. We're used to thinking about this in a political context, but the same is true in a commercial context. Mm-hmm. It's better to fight advertising fire with your own advertising fire.
One other area where there have been concerns raised about advertising is advertising to kids.
Mm-hmm.
During, say, Saturday morning cartoons or perhaps throughout the week, you know, on many channels, that kids, they don't have the critical thinking yet about it, and could just be pitched endlessly about what cereal to buy, what or have their parents buy, or what toys to buy.
Yes, and I do, in fact, in the book, defend advertising to children. I think if you look at countries that have banned advertising aimed at children, you don't see any of the expected benefits. You see mostly the fact that toys become more expensive, food becomes more expensive.
Now, how does it become more expensive?
Advertising drives consumer prices down. Whenever you ban advertising, prices end up going higher.
Now, how does that work? Because one would
think
that
if it facilitates competition.
Okay, because
if you don't have vigorous competition, prices will be higher. Again, dominant players in the toy industry in Europe loved ad bans of toys. Is what it did is it let them keep all those American toy companies out that would have come in through advertising. And what happened in the countries that banned the advertising to children is, as I said, products aimed at children became more expensive. I have two young children, and I'm very familiar with how advertising affects their interpretation of events and what they'd like to get for Christmas, believe me. But I think that we do children a great disservice when we assume that even children are like little robots, and you program them with advertising, and they do whatever you say. It's just not the way it happens in real life.
But a lot of people here at the holidays would say that is how it's happening, because the kids are just coming with long lists of what they want.
So what we want to do is buy things they don't want. This is my point. Advertising is a way that children learn about and think about and play with the idea of having a particular game or a particular piece of clothing. And the solution appears to be to stop all the advertising so that we as parents going out and buying for our children or telling Santa what Santa's going to bring to our children, we have less information. We're more likely to get something the children are going to be uninterested in. Because that advertising process has not helped to form preferences that the children actually care about.
Mm-hmm. On this idea of cost being driven down by advertising, but what if every company has to go out and advertise there? They're going to have to spend more money on an advertising and marketing budget when that has to come out of the bottom line somewhere and in the cost of the product that's being sold in the marketplace.
Yes, that argument's been made for 150 years, and I think that 150 years of research clearly suggests. And in fact, there's a great example in North Carolina decades ago. North Carolina is one of the few states that did not allow optometrists to advertise their wares. How much does an eye exam cost? How much do eyeglasses cost? North Carolina had notoriously high prices for eyeglasses and so on. And when the advertising restriction was lifted, real prices went down. When you limit advertising, you're basically limiting the competitive process. And when you restrict competition, you let existing players bid those prices up, not having the prices being bid down by potential competitors. Advertising restrictions are extremely damaging for consumers.
Does it always play out, though, that the little guy gets a leg up because of the advertising? If they're going up against, this huge, national company?
Absolutely not. There's no guarantees. Cola is dominated by two big players. There used to be lots of small players. There are still a few small players making soft drinks here in North Carolina. I happen to be a patron of Carolina Beverage, for example, that makes Sun Drop, my favorite drink. There's a little plug. But the big players do dominate that industry, apparently because consumers prefer the products that they're drinking. They have a free choice of options, and they have chosen the big players in this particular case. But advertising is not what drove away the business for some of these small firms. There were economies of scale that allowed the big manufacturers to make their products cheaper and to move them more effectively to consumers.
Let's go to Nina in Durham. Hi there, Nina.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the show.
It's great and very provocative. I'd like to go back to the culture question. I'm a person who believes that buying things doesn't really bring the true happiness that connecting with other people and more substantial interactions with the world do. And I feel that advertising is, by default, our nation's education system. As an educator, I see that companies and our nation spends far more on the whole advertising system than we do on educating children. And it certainly trumps what kids learn in school. And I think that this creates a culture where people learn to expect that they will get happiness by buying a certain product. And I think an earlier caller mentioned that sort of effect on culture, and I'm interested in more discussion about that issue.
Well, can I just ask you, you're a teacher. Do you have any opportunity to instill in your students this idea of critical thinking when it comes to the marketplace, of being skeptical?
Absolutely, but it's a very pervasive. It's far more pervasive and powerful and ever-present than anything I could ever say to a student.
Can you give us an example of what kind of roadblock you might run into in trying to get that across?
I'm actually in early childhood education, and the way I see it in a more global way. From even before a baby is born, starting with baby showers, parents are bombarded with information about having the best stuff. And I've visited other countries where there's not as much consumerism, and the occasion of having a new baby isn't about stuff. It's about sharing information and advice and enjoying the pleasure of being with each other and babies. And it just creates a whole different kind of a culture. When, I'm watching the advertising, the pre-holiday advertising, where we're seeing stories about moms who are torn about their family budget because they aren't sure they can afford the iPods that their kids want. I'm thinking, how sad, because that's not really what the holidays are supposed to be about.
Well, I'm going to put your comments to John Hood before we go. John?
Well, aren't iPods kind of neat? I mean, kids like them because they use them.
But they're $300 and some families can't afford
that. I understand that, but I'm just saying that the advertising is not inventing a desire for a product that has no meaning for people and no enjoyment for people. I appreciate the caller's views and discuss them again at great length in the book. I would just observe the countries that have less advertising, either because of restriction or culture, to be frank about it, they're not as happy as Americans are. I've looked at the evidence over the course of 30 or 40 years of public opinion surveys, and the countries that we would call more consumerist, like America, tend to have the happiest states of well-being. We have fewer people who are depressed. We have fewer people who are upset with the world. I'm not suggesting that materialism makes
people... I'm sure who are listening now who are kind of depressed with the idea of just being bombarded all the time.
I know. I'm not suggesting that materialism makes people happy. What I'm suggesting is that materialism doesn't keep people from being happy. And then in many ways, finding out what people like, finding out what my son likes for Christmas, I'm going to make him, I think, fairly happy with a gift that will be creative and won't cost very much, and I found out through advertising. Let's not take this argument, which we all agree with, that materialism is not it does not make us all feel better. Let's not take that too far and ignore the fact that material goods do have some value in our lives and we enjoy them.
Well, John Hood, we're going to have to end there for today, but thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
John Hood is president of the John Locke Foundation of Raleigh and author of Selling the Dream, Why Advertising is Good Business.